Have you ever wondered what sets the top 10% apart from the rest? Whether you're not in sales, understanding the habits and mindsets of top performers can make a huge impact on your success. Today, we'll explore what these high achievers do differently and how you can apply what they do to your strategies. Welcome to the Learn It All podcast, the show that helps today's leaders stay ahead of the game because we believe that great leaders aren't born or made, they're always in the making. I'm Damon Lemby, best-selling author and CEO of Learn It, a live learning platform that has helped upskill over 2 million people over the past 3 decades. Joining me for this episode, I'm excited to welcome Christy Jones, author of Selling Your Way In. Christy is a sales speaker, coach, and sales professional. Companies hire her to help elevate their sales organizations because most sales leaders understand that they're frustrated and just totally discouraged about the anemic pipelines that they have, their lower close rates, high attrition for poor and great performers, and really just missing targets. She's here today to help us unpack the key traits of what top 10% performers do differently and what helps them stay ahead of their competition. In today's episode, we're going to talk about the crucial habits the top 10% have outside of work, which is super important, that helps them stay sharp. Christy shared with us why it's so important to build a supportive circle of friends and mentors that can help fuel your success. We'll talk about the importance of balancing professional discipline and personal well-being. And you also need to know when to walk away from a career that isn't just the right fit for you. It's so important to know what your strengths are and find a career that you value and are passionate about. And we talk about so much more. Let's dive into this great conversation with Christy. Christy, welcome to the show.
Damon, thanks so much for having me on.
Well, I'm excited to talk to you. I just got done with your book and I got a bunch of questions, but let's just start off with, tell me a little bit about the kitchen table MBA you got.
Yes, absolutely. My parents owned a real estate franchise, a Coldwell Banker franchise. My dad was the owner broker. My mom was a top agent in town. And despite the fact that they worked in the same office, they didn't actually see each other throughout the day. So the kitchen table was the catch up for everything, not just school for my brother and me, but also for them to catch up on the day's events at the real estate office. So my brother and I say, got our MBA at the kitchen table. Everything was very transparent in our house. Nobody hid anything about money and what people were making. So we knew what my mom's commission checks were. I knew when my dad was and wasn't taking his own paycheck in order to make payroll, perhaps for the office employees. And so, you know, we really did, like, I really did think later in life, I thought I saved myself a lot of money just by being born into the right family and being able to get all of this financial acumen, financial literacy at the kitchen table and a bunch of business, you know, business advice at the same time.
I think that's great. It reminded me a lot of with my family, every Tuesday and Thursday, I go with my grandfather, my dad, and one of their business partners to breakfast and just kind of, you're just a sponge and you get to hear all of this work and, you know, and everything that they do. And it was fantastic. So I love that story that you had. So let's start with, share with our audience a little bit about how you got into sales.
Mm-hmm. Again, I do think there was a little bit of born into it, although my parents weren't always in sales. My mom started out as a teacher and my dad was in middle management at the United Telephone Company, which you could call today like an AT&T. So, but my first sales job was waiting tables. And I often talk to people like over and over and over when I bring this up, people like, me too. You know, I was in hospitality or I waited tables. I think every sales rep should wait tables. There are so many similarities. But I loved it, right? That was when I first really had figured out that I could own my own income, that really a good day at the restaurant was better than 4 days at the mall working, you know, working at the Gap at the mall like my friends were doing. So, and really fit my personality. I mean, it was, you know, it's a perfect job for an extrovert. I said it was, you know, fast-paced and personality-packed. But it had a lot of similarities from the standpoint of, you know, the section that I got assigned by management every day was the same as getting a territory assigned to you. You didn't always get to pick your clients, you know, whoever was sat right in your section, like, you know, and you had to think on your feet. You had to read people really quickly. You had to make quick decisions. You had to know, you know, you had to know your product. You know, I needed to know what they were out of in the kitchen. Did the salad have nuts in it? You know, those type of things. So, I mean, when you look back on it, there's so many similarities between waiting tables and that kind of, you know, commissionable sales job, right? So it was my first base plus commission, if you will. Only my base was $2.01 an hour. So you really did. I mean, you had to rely on, you know, you had to really rely on tips, but I made so much money. I mean, I made so much more money than the rest of my friends working half the time. So I think that's where, you know, I went from there into retail sales. I was a buyer for a major department store, but that's really, I think, where I got the bug of, hey, you really can control your own income.
No, it's great. And you don't want to be stuck in the smoking section, right?
You don't want to. No, I'm, we're, yeah, you and I are so old.
Yeah.
No, totally, the first thing you would do when you went home is you could probably take your clothes off in the garage and go straight to the shower, because it was awful. The smoking section was awful. Yeah, you had really done something wrong. If you got put in the smoking section, you were definitely on the wrong side of the manager.
And the same thing happens now in sales, right? Where you have, you just drop a bunch of grenades to a rep who's just not performing, right? They stick it. For now on, I'm just going to call it sticking them in the smoking section.
That's right. I like it.
Yeah. So from there, you know, you're working, I think you were in SaaS and you were even in BizLibrary too, right?
Yeah. I spent 10 years at BizLibrary. That was actually my first SaaS sales leadership role. Ironically, I'm back working with them right now, helping them hire some account executives and an SDR leader. So everything comes, never burn a bridge. Everything comes full circle. Yeah, I left there in 2010 and the CEO reached out to me about 5 or 6 months ago and said, we could use some help.
And for our listeners out there, I think that's so important. Never burn a bridge. And that goes for prospects and customers too. If you lose a deal, you know, take it, just take it and even ask them maybe, hey, what could I do differently next time? And stay engaged, because you never know. And the same goes with how you leave a company you work for. I always like to say at Learn It, some of my best employees, this is their second or third tour at Learn It, because sometimes they realize that it's just not, grass isn't always greener on the other side.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. That goes to the Christie-ism, do the right things and the right things will happen.
You just stole my favorite Christie-ism.
I knew you were, I thought you were setting me up.
I was trying. Yeah. Okay. do the right thing. That was when I played baseball, my Hall of Fame coach had two rules: show up on time and do the right thing. Mm-hmm. Have integrity and show up on time. Yep. So now that you threw me a curveball, let's get to, how did you end up going on your own?
Oh, I got laid off. Okay. Yeah. I mean, that's true. People ask me all the time, like, what made you decide to start your own company? And honestly, after I'd gotten laid off and they were restructuring the company and moving, I built an SDR team, the very first SDR team at the company from 0 to 13, and it had been under the sales umbrella, and they decided to move it under the marketing umbrella, which I was all for and had been encouraging. Not to realize that I was going to, you know, work myself right out of a job, but the marketing department was out of Phoenix, Arizona, and I was in St. Louis, Missouri. And so they, you know, made me an offer of staying on for 3 months. They would pay me 3 months severance if I stayed on for 3 months while they were rebuilding it in another city and state. I said yes to that. So I really went in search of my next VP of sales job. And in the process of networking, I say the universe conspired to force me into starting my own business. That was really a series of events. And when people call me and say, hey, I want to hear your founder story, or, you know, how did you get started? I immediately say to them, like, you're not going to like my story, right? Because I didn't do the struggle hustle, but I do believe I wasn't lucky. It was the do the right things and the right things will happen. And I have been doing the right things with a number of people over the years and helping out where I could, you know, free consulting, as I called it. And then all of these things happened like simultaneously. And before my 3 months was up, I had started my own business, which I had really intended to do. Like, consulting had been on the radar for me, but I still had a child who was in high school. And for some reason, I had it in my head that consulting might require travel. And so I didn't think it was the right time to do it. But, you know, another motto of mine is, when the universe speaks, listen. And it was clear that there were so many things happening at the same time, simultaneously, on top of one another, that for me to have like not paid attention and walked away would have been a complete, it just would have been the wrong thing to do. Like, it was so clear that this is what I was supposed to do.
One of the things you said a moment ago was, you know, I wasn't lucky, or maybe I was lucky. At the end of the day, I think we create our own luck, and things happen because we put ourselves in a position by doing the right things, working hard, networking. I think that's also important. One other question I had before going on your own: when you were first told that you were going to be let go and you had, you could stay around for 3 months, was your immediate reaction like, I want to get out of here? Or did you say, you know what, I'm going to suck it up, I'm going to stay here for the 3 months, see this out, and then go from there?
Yeah, that's a great question. I was completely caught off guard. My boss was in San Francisco. I knew he was coming into town. He didn't just show up unannounced, but I was so excited. He'd actually never been to St. Louis and he'd never met my team. And so I thought he was just coming in for, like, you know, meet the team, new visit. His plane was running behind and he'd asked me to stay late at the office. And so he showed up a little after 6 p.m. And this was around the holidays. And this was between Thanksgiving and Christmas. And then proceeded to tell me what was going to happen. And then he said, we would like you to stay on for 3 months while we rebuild it. And we will pay you accordingly to the regular comp plan you're on. Plus we'll give you 3 months severance if you do that. And I said it, I had to kind of bring my body back into the room because I realized I'd been asked a question I needed an answer to. And I was trying to, like, hold the tears back and, you know, make sure I didn't just flip out in front of him. And I just said, I'm going to need some time to think about it. And at that point he said, you know, I'm back on a plane tomorrow night and the offer expires at that point. And I was like, yikes. So that was a very sleepless night, but I woke up the next day and, you know, it really wasn't a matter of money because I'm a really good saver. That was part of the things that I learned from my parents, and I had the money to say no to that. But I didn't think it was the right thing to do. And I knew that the next morning, one of the things that was happening was that he was going to tell my team. And I was committed to being there as well. I sat in the back of the room and I didn't say anything, but I felt like it was wrong to not, you know, I didn't really feel any ill will. I mean, I was shocked, but I didn't feel any ill will. I thought the decision they were making was the right one. How it was happening was a little bit shocking, but in general, it was what I wanted to happen. I wanted the SDR team under the marketing department instead of the sales department. And I remember that one decision, the number of people that approached me over those 3 months and just said, like, I don't think I could have done what you've done. Like, I don't think I could have continued to come in. I mean, the operations manager, the head of customer service, like, you know, over time individually, people were, you know, I would go sit in somebody's office at the end of the day and just, you know, grab a beer or whatever, because, you know, it was a startup. But he would say, like, you know, like, I don't think I could have done. I don't think I could have walked through the door every day for 90 days like you did. And it wasn't easy, but it also wasn't hard. It was, I mean, sure, the first few times walking in were completely awkward. And then it just, you know, it was, again, like, I was being paid to do a job and they deserved to get, you know, value for what they were paying me. And that was sort of how I just worked it out every day in my head.
I think it shows a lot about your character and your courage. I really mean that.
Thank you.
Because, and, you know, you had, I think you said 13 SDRs in a room who were probably, you know, probably relatively early in their career. And I think that you set a great example for them moving forward and everybody else. And just by showing up, being professional, and I bet you that was a great learning lesson for them throughout their career. So, you know, good for you for doing that. Yeah, a lot of people wouldn't handle it that way. They would have been like, I'm out.
Yeah. I mean, you got to think they were about to get the same, like, shock and awe that I had gotten the night before. And the only other person who understood what they were feeling at the time was me. And, you know, one by one, I brought them into my office after he had left and just like, where are you at? Where's your head at? Where's your heart at? How are you feeling? Because it does, like, it had not been the first time that had happened to me, but it was the first time it had happened, to your point, to a lot of people. And they kept some of those individuals. Some of those individuals became, you know, solution consultants. One went into sales ops, a couple went into marketing, and then some were let go. They got to interview for other jobs in the organization, but not everybody made the cut. But I had been let go before. I'd worked with a company where we were VC backed and they sold us off. And I was employee number one let go at that organization. They wanted all executives to be in Florida. The company who'd bought us was a competitor. This was way pre-pandemic. So the older white guys were like, you can't do business remotely. You got to be in Florida. And I, again, like, my child was way younger at that point. And I was like, yeah, I can't move to Florida. And so I'd been employee number one let go. And so I had already lived through that. And it is when your self-worth to some extent is tied to what you do, and mine is very tightly tied to what I do, you get up in the morning without purpose, right? I mean, you know, you don't have purpose. And I think that's part of the reason why I said yes to the deal, which is to have to get up every, I knew what it was like to get up every morning and force yourself to the computer room to send out X number of resumes. And when it happened to me the first time, I was like, it's a 4-hour-a-day job. Like, emotionally, I could not do it any more than 4 hours a day. So, you know, I got my child off to school and then I would sit down at the computer and, you know, do research and network and send out resumes till about noon. And then I had to do something else. And so, you know, again, like, I just, I think there's so many things that I've had experiences for in my life. And I feel, again, that family MBA is one of them, where I feel an obligation to teach and help other people who didn't grow up the way I grew up or haven't had the experiences that I've had. And like you said, like, and I had handpicked these people, right? Like this was you as a sales leader, you very rarely get to build a team from zero. So like all of these were my people. Like
right.
I had interviewed them. I had hired them. I had onboarded them. This was my team. You know, I hadn't inherited a single person. So I think, you know, like all of that played into that.
Right. And like you say in your book, what we're going to get into right now, selling your way in, is that you kind of felt like you had a responsibility to share your experiences with everybody. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah. I mean, I think as I got older, you know, you don't know what you don't know, right? Like you just think everybody's family's, you know, talking shop at the kitchen table at night, because that's really the experience that you have. But as I got older, I realized that that wasn't the case. And sometimes I would get frustrated with people and my friends would say to me, we didn't grow up like you did, right? Like our dad didn't take us down to the bank every Saturday morning and make us fill out the withdrawal slip or the deposit slip, even if it was a dollar. You know, they're like you had a very different upbringing than a lot of people. And at that point, you know, like one of the things I started doing pretty early on, even when I was back at Biz Library, is that I started teaching junior achievement. And my dad had taught junior achievement and I had thought that was super cool. And then my boss had said to me, like, you are going to burn out if you don't like start not doing right. something, but working 60 hours a week here at Biz Library. And so I was like, oh, like he basically forced me to do charity work and, you know, work for a nonprofit. And so, but the thing I loved about that, the thing I still love about junior achievement is it has every single lesson at every single grade level has a financial component. And I think it's so important for girls, particularly like mm-hmm. I teach seventh grade international business. And one of the schools I had taught at for a while was an all girls school. And then I teach second grade called our community. I give them little coins and they like one of them becomes the florist and one of them becomes the pizza shop and one of them becomes the, you know, bank and whatever. And I love junior achievement for that reason. And I love the fact that I, as a female who owns her own business, can go in and girls can see that, you know, this is possible. And, you know, she knows how to talk about money. So yeah, I do feel like I have a responsibility to help people, you know, like, you know, when people get stock options, right? So, I mean, I work with a lot of startups and most people don't, I mean, like they get, you know, they get excited. They're like, ooh, I get stock options. And I like, you know, in the first week or two, I'll bring them into my office and I'll be like, do you even know what this is or what you're supposed to do with it? And they don't always realize that they have to buy them out, right? And so particularly because you're in the sales department, I say, hey, when you get a really big commission check, like buy some options. Like, you know, you don't want to, in the company that I was laid off from, I was fortunate enough, again, I bought all of my options before I walked out the door. And that turned into be the first unicorn in their space. And, you know, yeah. And so I benefited from having that knowledge and doing what I had been, again, what I had been telling other people they needed to do. And the employees that were let go in the next few weeks from that organization, I said to them, like, beg, borrow, and steal money from your family, your friends, or whatever, and buy your options because this company is going to go unicorn. Like, I just knew they were going to be the first unicorn in their space. And it turned out that way. And people called me, you know, when they got the letter and said, this is happening, my former employees called me and said, thank you so much for telling us to do that. Because, you know, this is not like, you know, retirement life-changing money for us because we weren't there that long, but it's money I would have never had you not told me what to do.
I'm sure that made you feel great.
It did. But again, it was part of that. It's part of that, like, that's just do the right thing. Like you, like, you know, as much as everybody was upset and I was upset, like, let's not let our emotions, you know, like let's not have our heart overrule our head in this financial decision.
Totally.
Like, just because we're upset and mad does not mean we should walk away from free money.
Can't cut off your nose to spite your face.
Right. Right.
Yeah. No, I think so many things you said in there. I mean, you may not believe this, but I got a 6-year-old daughter, right? So, you know, I think financial responsibility, I didn't learn that kind of stuff in school. I mean, if somebody asked me if there's two things they could change in high school or college, teach more about sales for one, and also
for
just
one.
And financial responsibility, personal financing. And two, I really love the fact that you wanted to be a role model for young women. And I think that's so great. You know, and my little Lucy, you know, that, you know, she's going to be coming up, you know, she's in first, second grade. So getting back to your book, who is it for?
Yeah, it's for about, it's about three groups of people. Although I think lots of people who even aren't in sales would enjoy reading it. I think there's lots of just life lessons in there. But the first person it's for is for somebody who isn't sure if they want to go into sales, right? Who's giving it some thought, mm-hmm. but hasn't made the decision. Perhaps they're in college. Perhaps they're thinking about a career change. Because I think my book will help them pick a better first sales job than they might have otherwise chosen. So I think this get to know yourself before you get to know the prospects, that first section of really understanding your strengths and superpowers will help them perhaps pick a job that they might not have otherwise chosen, or they might have chosen the wrong job. So I think it's that person number one. I think the second group of people that it's for are people who are, you know, been in their career a little bit, but they're struggling. They aren't at the top 10%. They don't really understand why. You know, I say that, you know, I'm saying what Susan's saying. I'm listening to her gong calls and Susan's right. saying this and I'm saying that too, but I'm still not making what Susan's making. You're confused as to why you're not at the top. And then I think that last group of people is people who maybe need a little bit, like sales is a high rejection sport. There's a lot, you know, it will wear you down. I think it's those people who are near the top or at the top or who've been at the top and just need a little injection of something else. I think that whole third section, I call it the mental side of sales. I think the people who can get to the top and stay at the top are doing things very differently outside of work than just, you know, I'm saying things differently than Susan or better than Susan. And so I think it's for that third group of people is people who, you know, are doing a lot of the right things, but maybe they haven't like touched on everything that's on that mental, physical, spiritual side of sales.
And whether it's in sales, I'm talking about the third group now, whether it's in sales or it's in sports, you see some of the greatest athletes or producers, they're consistent, and it's what they do off the court or, you know,
right.
out of the office that is really what sets them apart. Because there's a lot of people, Christy, who have natural ability, and there's a lot of people who have natural ability when it comes to sales too, mm-hmm. but they're just not, you know, doing the right things outside of the office. Now, I just recommended your book to, I've got a buddy of mine's daughter is, she doesn't think she wants to be in sales, right? But he's just like, you should read this book and just be open-minded because you got a great personality, you're disciplined and you're a hard worker. So just at least give it some thought. So I think that's one of the recommendations for our listeners out there. If you're not in sales right now, even if you're in accounting or something like that, but if you've ever even been curious about it, I think you should check out Christy's book.
Thank you. Yeah, I think one of the things that caused me to write the book is that everybody thinks sales and they think hunter. And, you know, and they think like, you know, hardcore sales and pressure right. and this, that, and the other. And what I'm here to say is make a very nice living with a variable comp plan. Maybe it's not a 50-50 and maybe it's not 100% commission, but there are so many sales jobs out there that are, you know, relationship, farmer, you know, again, if you're technically minded, solution consultant, sales engineer, if you like getting people, you know, if you got that teacher side of you, then you could be the implementation specialist. There are so many jobs under the sales umbrella that will give you some variable compensation or bonus that aren't like starting at zero every month as a hunter. And I think we only like, you know, you watch TV and movies and these are the things, you know, these are the ones that are so controversial and, you know, and sometimes give us a bad name.
Exactly. It's like a stigma or a label, you know, and it's really not true. Right. I mean, so mm-hmm. there's a lot of different roles in sales that people should be open-minded and explore. What I'm most fascinated about, and you and I spoke about this backstage, is top 10%. So let's start with a definition of what you mean by top 10% and what do they do differently than the other 90%?
Yeah, the top 10% are out-earning and out-working their coworkers and their competitors. So it may be that you're at the top 10% and, you know, at your company, but you also may be a top 10%er in your industry. You know, you're winning deals away from the competition or you're winning more than your fair share of deals, you know, within your industry itself. And so, you know, I ask an interview question every time I interview someone, and this is the question, so here's your freebie. Name three things that you do consistently that regardless of the company you're working for, or the job role that you're in, that you truly believe, like if I do these three things, I think I can be successful. And top 10%ers will tell me I'm at the gym at 6 a.m. I have a religious or a spiritual practice. I have a, you know, a tight group of friends. We get together monthly or quarterly. You know, I have a group of, I talked to a candidate earlier this week and who said, like, we built our own little sales group. Like, a bunch of my friends are in sales and we get together regularly and share ideas on what's working and what's not working. Positive self-talk and affirmation. Like, I constantly say, like, this is a high rejection sport. If you take things personally or you like, everybody's going to have a slump. Like, we're going back to the baseball analogy because I talked about baseball earlier because you played baseball growing up. And, you know, like, everybody's going to get in a slump. And here's what people don't do. Here's what the 90% do. They only postmortem the deals they lost. Top 10%ers postmortem every deal. And they know why they won those deals. And then they put that down on paper. What were the things they did right that caused that deal to close? And so when you hit a slump, and top 10%ers are going to hit a slump occasionally as well, they have a reference guide, right? They have somewhere to go to say, oh my gosh, like, because habits form fast, but they also crash fast, right? And so top 10%ers know that everything will, be, like you said, be consistent, consistently doing the right things. But sometimes the right thing falls off the radar. But top 10%ers aren't just postmorteming the losses. They're analyzing everything because they need to know what worked and what will continue to work.
I mean, to me, it sounds like what I preach a lot is lifelong learning and always wanting to get better and learning from every situation, and which I think is great. It's like, let's just not be curious about why we lost. And sometimes the 90% aren't even curious about why they lost.
Right. Because you're right. I'm giving them some
victims.
Credit.
They're victims, yeah. Right?
It's, it's. Yeah, they're not even doing the postmortem.
No, they're not even doing postmortem. Our pricing was too high. I didn't get my company support. It's, all that nonsense, right? So you are giving them credit. Talking about, which I think is great for our listeners out there, hey, look at why you won and dig into that and remember that for the future. I think that's awesome. What are some of the other key traits that you see across the board for the 10%ers?
They're getting enough. They're getting 8 hours of sleep. They're putting the right food in their body. They understand the mind-body connection. So they're making sure that they're exercising regularly. This one's a big one for me. Like, your circle matters. I think sometimes you don't really understand the impact that your circle has. You know, are they on the journey with you or not with you? And I, believe in, I call it reason, season, lifetime. So you've heard this phrase before. Not everybody's supposed to be there for the long haul. Right? Some people are just there for a reason. And in some cases, you got to throw some fish back in the water. Sometimes it's time to move on from people who are, negative, who are struggling with their own situation and trying to bring you down, or who sucking emotional energy, like the emotional vampire, as I call them. Those individuals, again, like, depending on who they are in their life, it's harder to get rid of family members who fall into this category than friends. But I mean, in general, I love the Jim Rome quote. You'll be as successful as the five closest people to you. And I mean, there's a reason why he says that. And I totally buy into this concept. And again, they don't have to be in sales, right? But they have to be positive, positive influences in your life. They have to be people of, high value, character and integrity. They need to be people that will be there for you. You don't know when you're going to, when your true friends are, when you really need something and they show up for you. They say one of the things that I read this article a while ago, and this has just really stuck with me, but they said one of the things that people never forget and that puts you at the top of the friend list is showing up at the funeral.
Interesting.
Right? When people's darkest days are there, the people who showed up at the funeral, those are your people. That separates those reason and season people from the lifetime people a lot of times.
And Chrissy, what I've learned as I've, I'm in my 50s now, is that I used to have hundreds of friends, tons of friends. And you don't need that many friends anymore. You really don't. And now I've kind of narrowed it down and really been a lot more self-aware, which I'm sure is a top trait.
It is a top trait. Yep.
But self-aware, who you're surrounded by, I mean, it makes such a difference. And I like what you're saying, that one of the things that the top 10%ers do is they go out and they find a sales community, whether it's on LinkedIn or somewhere else, and they just start talking to people. Because it's better to talk to those people who are interested and you can run ideas by, than if you're in office or even virtually and you got negative Nancy there who all they want to do is just talk about how shitty everything is all the time.
Yeah, when I was I went from being a buyer at a major department store to walking in my first day at Biz Library back in 2000, and I didn't know anything. Like, he goes, what do you want title to be? And I'm like, I don't know. Like, he called me operations manager, and I just followed him around like a puppy for a while. And all of a sudden he started giving me sales leadership, some sales leader responsibility. He's like, hey, you've done interviewing before, you know, you've interviewed people. Why don't you take over interviewing sales professionals? And then it became, why don't you onboard them as well? And then it became, why don't you keep them for the first 6 months? And as I saw the writing on the wall, I reached out to a recruiter friend of mine, Steve. And I said, hey, I'm starting to get myself into a situation that I didn't know that I was going to be in. And so he recruited sales professionals for small businesses around town. And I said, I need to know every sales leader that you know who's in a privately owned company with fewer than 25 or 50 employees. And I started a sales leadership roundtable group, some of which, and so one of those, by the way, one of the owners of that group that joined my group was client number two when I started my consulting business. And so we literally every month we met at somebody's, you know, office, and we just brought our problems to the table. I mean, we were so, like, our companies were so small that, like, you know, some guy shows up and says, well, I've got my first female sales rep going on maternity leave. Now what? like he goes, do I pay her? Do I not pay her? What do I do with her deals? Like, they, you know, we were literally, like, none of us had a handbook. Like, we built a handbook together. Like, nobody even had a handbook. So yeah, I mean, so like that, and honestly, like that circle, I got a call the other day from one of the guys in that group who I'd gotten a close relationship with, who'd just been laid off, you know, and he called to kind of, you know, get some moral support and see if I could help, you know, with any ideas that I had. And that group, like, I still hear from that group regularly. And that, and was, you know, that was 24 years ago.
And isn't that cool? And it's great. It sounds like you're surrounding, first of all, people who are creative, innovative to think differently and think out of the box to do this, but also vulnerable enough, pushing their ego aside and saying, hey, I need help, you know, because none of us can go at it alone. Right.
Yep. So that's right. That's a very lonely place to be.
It's a very lonely place to be. And I think that that's especially important for times like right now, where sales aren't easy. I don't care. I don't know what industry is. I mean, mostly all my friends are in sales, or the people I mentor, and, you know, it's challenging. And sometimes you don't have as many meetings. So why not get creative with your time and find ways to make yourself, get yourself better? And what else? Discipline is a big, a big part when it comes to top 10%, right?
Yeah, that's a big topic within the book is you have to have your own, you know, I call it your personal sales process, right? Your company may have a sales process, but you need to know how to spin it to play to your sales superpowers and your sales secret weapons. But then you have to have the discipline to do it, right? The majority of people, you know, I get frustrated because in our world, there's a lot of talk about, you know, like, we're not even getting to 50% of quota, and the quotas are too, you know, like, for whatever reason, there's a lot of them. Mm-hmm. But the fact of the matter is, like, the number one reason people are missing quota is they don't have enough pipeline. And so, you know, the discipline to prospect every day, to set aside that time, to time block to do that. And that, but the discipline goes throughout the entire part of the top 10%er's life, right? If you're going to be at the gym every morning at 6, well, that requires a lot of discipline, right? For the alarm to go off at 5:15 or 5:30 and to get out of bed day in and day out, and to go to bed at a decent hour and read a business book instead of watching The Bachelorette. You know, like, all of that requires discipline. And so that, like, it is something that I don't talk a ton about, but it's definitely there for all the top 10%ers, because all of that stuff takes discipline, right? I mean, pushing out the negative self-talk and replacing that with positive self-talk, that's discipline, that's habit. You know, so I think those are the kind of things that it just, like, the top 10%ers are just doing them. That's why I say, like, people don't, like, you're sitting next to Susan and you can't figure out why you can't make what Susan's making and why you're not, you know, hitting quota. But Susan's, like, not going to bed at midnight, and Susan's not eating ice cream at 8 o'clock, and Susan's, you know, at the gym every morning, and Susan's surrounding herself with the right people. But Susan, like, you never see that, right? You don't see that on Slack, and now we're remote, you really don't see it, right? I mean, we're remote, and sometimes you know about people and sometimes you don't, but time in and time out, like, the majority of top 10%ers and majority of candidates that I interview, that I recommend for clients to hire, like, former athletes, working out all the time, you know, gave up drinking, talk about, like, you know, I put my phone down for 2 hours a day so I can be present with my family. Like, they, and it's just, that's not, they don't think about it as being disciplined. That's just how they live their life. But it had to start, you're right. They had to be disciplined at some point for that to then become a habit and be part of their everyday life.
And when I was reading your book, I was thinking, because you and I are athletes, and I think that kid's kind of ingrained in you a little bit. And the other thing that you talked about in your book, which I love, is that you can outwork people as well.
That's,
you know,
right.
And that's something, because there's certain things that we're not you know, you're not born with. There, you know, certain things you can't do, but one thing you can do is you can put in the work and outwork That's people.
Right. Yep. And I think, you know, I used to say to reps, and I still say this, like, I don't care if you work harder or you work smarter. I've seen both strategies work. So, you know, if you're not the person who can, you know, smooth talk their way through the gatekeeper to get to the, you know, C-level or V-level person, and you just have to make more calls to the mid-level managers and work your way up, like, there, yeah, you don't have to be, you really don't have to necessarily be the smartest person in the room. You can just outwork people. And I've seen it time and time again. And, you know, and I, like, I've got a 25-year-old son, and he's working for a major Fortune 500 company currently. And I said, hey, listen, like, sometimes the difference between getting that promotion and not getting that promotion is just an extra 3 or 4 hours a week, you know, and not just for FaceTime reasons, but because you're really working, you know, on your professional development, your personal development, you're really not leaving the office until you've got that problem solved and you make sure that that reports in on time. Like, all of those kind of things. Like, the other thing is that the other thing that falls under that discipline, in my opinion, and it also goes to the value system, character, integrity, is walk your talk. Do what they, top 10%ers, do what they say they're going to do when they say they're going to do it. And that builds trust in ways that a lot of other things don't.
I can't even emphasize that enough. And one thing I want to, well, I always call it, Chris, I say, don't overpromise and underperform.
Yep.
You know, and sometimes that happens because you get really excited, whether it's about an opportunity, a deal or something, and you tell your client you're going to get back to them. Well, think about it. And if you say it's going to take you a week to get them what they need, then give yourself a week and a half. Give yourself some buffer room so you can exceed expectations instead of falling flat on your face. Or, you know, just lead by example and go out and do the work that needs to be done. One of my closest friends is one of the most, you know, successful sales guys I know. He just did the same thing. Is he just outworked everybody? You know, he just showed up and he did the work. And he said, I was never the smartest guy in the room. And but you don't need to be. I think that's great.
Yeah, I think the other thing that, you know, that I've been, that I really wrote the book for, is I think a lot of people have been very reactive about their sales career and careers in general, right? And so it's so baffling to me. I think it's just so weird because we spend all this time like making sure we understand the ICP, our ideal customer profile. We know who our persona is. We learn everything about them, you know, because we want to make a very targeted, you know, we're going to call in very intentionally and targeted to people that we think, you know, will be good prospects for us and really should be customers for our company. And then we take a job because a recruiter calls or because Damon calls me and says, oh my gosh, Christy, like I finally left the company we were working at and I've been at this company for 6 months and you're going to love it. You should totally come here and work here. And we are so reactive about our careers. And I said, I'm waiting for the day. I'm looking forward to the day when someone sends me a resume and says, hey, I've done some research. I know you're consulting and working with this company and I've done some research and my sales superpowers and my strengths and my secret weapons are like a perfect fit. You should interview me. Like, you should give me 30 minutes. Like, no, like, it's so funny how we spend all of this time being proactive and intentional about reaching out to the right ICP. And yet we are so reactive about our career. And that's why, and I do think that's why people end up in the wrong sales job. Right? Like, they're flattered, like a recruiter calls. And again, remember, the recruiter's in sales too. So the recruiter calls like, oh my gosh, I saw your LinkedIn profile. Like, you're perfect for my client. Like, you know, they would love to have you. Or you call me and you flatter me by saying, oh my gosh, Christy, like, you could be making so much more money over here. But if it's not, like, you know, I say, like, the intentionality with your career is picking the right sales role, selling the right thing in the right industry and the right market, but being with the right company and the right sales leader. And so I know that a lot of companies don't, their interview process is not a two-way street. I make sure that mine and the ones that I'm involved with my clients are a two-way street, because I say to the candidate, you should know way before I know whether or not this is a good idea or a bad idea, because you know yourself better than I'm ever going to know you in 4 or 5 hours. But I think people are not taking that time. Like, there's a workbook, by the way, that comes with the book. Like, there's QR codes throughout the book. Please download the workbook. It's over 40 pages. I spent a lot of time on it. But it's, you know, it's a guide, right? Because if you really don't understand your sales superpowers or your secret weapons, or like, what's your reward system, right? What's your risk tolerance? Like, when you think about your friend's daughter who was like, oh my gosh, not sales, like, she's got a risk profile that doesn't probably lend itself to Hunter, but might lend itself to customer success manager, right? But if you don't really understand all of those things, then how on earth, when you go to interview for a job, will you know whether or not that matches your reward system, your risk tolerance, the superpowers that you have? And so I think people are leaving up to $2 million of lifetime income on the table by picking the wrong jobs and then not changing jobs at the right time in their career.
I agree with you. I mean, think about that for a second. That's a lot of money. And I also think that, and I think I've heard you say this, if you're unsure, I mean, obviously you could read your book, but you could also ask people who know you.
Absolutely. Yeah. I listened to a podcast called My First Million, and I was out for my walk yesterday and listening to it. And they were talking about high performers and how high performers, and they said, like, if you're not sure, everybody else around you is. Like, you're the only one who's not sure, right? Everyone else around you knows what your strengths are. And, you know, and again, I do, like, in the book, I do offer questions, right? Like, what do people come to advice for you about? You know, what seems to come easy for you and hard for other people? Like, there is a whole list that you can, you know, figure this out. But that goes back, Damon, to the self-awareness, right? Mm-hmm. If you don't have self-awareness around what makes you unique, I'll go back to the sales analogy. What are your unique differentiators, right? What differentiates you from someone else? If you don't understand those unique differentiators, how on earth will you be able to communicate them in a way that will help land you the right job?
And Chrissy, it doesn't always have to be, you know, you're interviewing, you're out of work, you're interviewing to get a new job. You know what I see? I'm sure that you see this all the time. I had somebody that I mentor call me about 8 months ago who absolutely crushes it as an individual contributor, absolutely crushes it as an individual contributor, and said, my CEO wants to promote me into becoming a sales leader. And I, you know what I said? Don't do it. You know, don't do it. Think about what your strengths are and what you like to do and how you basically lack patience on certain things and don't do it. But he went ahead and did it because he's like, it's going to look good on my resume. You know, I want to get into leadership. What advice do you have for people like that? Because now the guy, I had lunch with him 2 days ago or last week, he's freaking miserable. He hates it. And that's important I know I'm going on a little bit of a rant here, but that's important for sales leaders and CEOs as well to not blindly go in and promote people who are going to have a negative impact on themselves and their team that they lead.
Yeah, this is definitely on the pet peeve passion project for me. Like, again, particularly in the SaaS B2B space, we love to promote the top performer to sales leader. And I've been going down this rant because in general, I'm asking this question every time I interview candidates, and I'm asking them what formal soft skills sales training have you been provided by your current or previous companies? And well over 75 to 80% of the time, I'm hearing I've had no formal or professional sales training the way you describe it. I've got product training. They've been giving me industry training, but no one has been sitting down and giving me sales soft skills training. And so if we're not giving sales soft skills training to the individual contributors now, who hopefully will become top producers at some point, and then we turn around and promote them into sales leader, and we've not provided them the proper training, which we're not, for the most part, providing them proper training throughout their early stages of their career, then I think the art of sales, as I call it, is going to become extinct. We are so concentrated now on the science of sales. You know, we've got all of these software programs. We've got all of this reports. We've got all of this data. We got AI, you know, and we were relying on that to manage teams. And we're not teaching basic, like, table stakes sales skills, like negotiation skills. How do we handle objections? You know, I call it asking a question on a question. So not just asking the one surface level question, like, forcing yourself to ask follow-up questions based on the answer that you're being given. That's, you know, that takes a lot of role play in order to do that. But we're just not doing that anymore. And so, you know, that would be thing one. So not surprising, like, not only surprising that your mentee, you know, was like, oh geez, what have I done? But because it was probably unprepared. The company didn't prepare him not only to be a leader, which, by the way, that we're going to throw them in the sales leadership. We're not going to give him any leadership training either, by the way. But not only does he not have leadership training, he probably doesn't even have a sales methodology that he can teach the team, because he was probably never taught a sales methodology. And so now he's in this Bermuda Triangle of hell, right? Where he's like, oh my gosh, what have I done? So yeah, I mean, I think that's a self-awareness thing, right? But that goes back to what I'd said earlier, like that was flattery, right? They were like, oh my gosh, what a big compliment whatever. But that doesn't mean that that's the right place for you. And again, it's no big secret that individual contributors normally out earn their leaders. So, you know, yes, if you truly like, you know, leadership is my thing, but I believe that traits are set by 10 years of age. So, and thinking that you can change.
Talk about that a little bit more.
Well, I mean, I always sort of felt a little bit like this, but then I went and got 2 days of training on an assessment called the Cultural Index. And I drank the Kool-Aid before, like they are so certain of this that when you go and apply for a job for companies who are using the Cultural Index, the very first thing you do when you get the resume, after you've looked the resume over and think like, yes, this is a potential candidate, is you ask them to take the assessment. You don't do a phone screen. You don't talk to them. You don't send them an email other than like, hey, I'd like you to go ahead and take this assessment. And out of the, like, I don't know, there's like 20 some odd profiles of different types of people. There's about 3 or 4 that would fit, that would make a good salesperson. One of them's called the Rainmaker. So everybody would love to have a Rainmaker on their team. But they after sitting through 2 days of class and learning how to really, like, you know, learn how to manipulate the assessment or, you know, read the assessment, all of those type of things and what kind of people to avoid and what kind of people to move towards. It really is like traits are really set at 10. And they really can't be changed. And so I say, like, anybody can do anything for 18 months. And that's one of the things that really upsets me about our industry is that the starter job in sales is SDR, which means the starter job in sales is hunter. Where's the CSM starter job? Where's the solution consultant starter job? Where's the implementation specialist? You know, where's the sales ops starter job? And the reason why I think so many people get, you know, drop out of sales after having that SDR job is, like, it's really a small percentage of the population who hunts, like, you know, who that hunter job will really work out for you and it fits your traits that were set at 10. And so, you know, people get in there and they go, oh yeah, this is awful. Like, I would never want to be an AE, right? Because that's the career path from SDR is AE. But like, they're like, I would never want to be an AE. This is awful. And so they leave sales when instead they should have been a CSM, a solution consultant, an implementation or onboarding specialist, or in sales ops. And then we lose them completely.
No, I think that's a great point because that is everywhere you see it's the entry point into sales is an SDR and very few people are hunters. Some of them are helpers, right? There's a Christianism for you, right? Some of them are helpers.
That's right.
Hunters aren't.
Right. That's right. Hunters aren't helpers. And you're right. And there are lots of people. And again, there are plenty of helper jobs under the sales umbrella. You just have to find the right helper job for you. So yeah, I hope your friend, again, they're nothing, by the way, no bad job cannot be undone. I took a job after, I took a VC backed company job because I wanted to be able to check the international box. I had never managed an international team and I had lost a job because of it. A job I desperately wanted because I couldn't check the international box. So I got an opportunity to run a team in Canada. So, you know, I was like, at least I can be able to check the, it's not EMEA, it's not APAC, but okay, fine. But I got in there and in 4 months, it was CPG. It was I'd come from the SaaS world but I was like, no, it's VC backed. The two guys who were running it, the CEO and the COO had just turned around Breyers Ice Cream. So one of the things that's very attractive to me is working for really smart people. And so I was like, these guys are like amazing and my boss is going to be amazing. And I was everything. And I was in and out of there in 8 months. Right? It did not fit my trait set. I wasn't passionate about it. It was holistic dog and cat food. And I was like, oh my gosh, what have I done? I'm like, oh my, like, you know, there's, you know, ingredients are missing. You know, we've got ingredients that are running out and all, it was awful. So no bad step change, if you want to call it, as I call it, no bad job cannot be undone. So if you get yourself into a situation where you're like, I've made a bad decision, like you can't do it. You can't do it 7 out of 8 jobs, right? Because that creates a pattern and then we lack self-awareness and all this stuff. But you can talk one bad job away. And I tell people, I go, I did it. I've made a bad mistake. I left SaaS. And 8 months later, I got back into SaaS. And then I knew for sure, right? Then I totally knew that that was my swim lane. Like I wanted to be in early stage B2B SaaS startup companies and having that one experience. But I knew right away and I took action right away. So you can make a bad step change. You can take the wrong job for you, but but you can undo anything.
Well, what you're saying is also you want to be intentional, right, about yes. how you go about your career. And I also want to point out, whether it's for my mentee or for others who are individual contributors who get promoted to a manager, go talk to your leader before you leave, right? And maybe go back to your individual contributor position, because I know as a small business owner, if I have one of my top producer was promoted to a leader, and I'm miserable in that position, I would much rather have them go back to becoming an individual contributor than Absolutely. have them leave.
Leave to another company. Absolutely, you would.
Yeah. So get out there and communicate. Well, we're kind of coming up on time, but I do, before we go, I got my Christyism cards right here. My Christyism, awesome. Christy cards. So I'm just going to pull out one or two and just see what happens and read it to you and tell me okay. what it means to you.
Let's do it.
People are patterns.
Ah, yes, I do believe that people are patterns, and I guess I just use a good example of that, right? If you are continually taking the wrong job over and over and over, that's a pattern. We should probably not hire that individual, but I do look for that, right? I do think that people are patterns, and so the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior, which gets to the pattern problem as well. So yeah, pay attention to people who are patterns, and by the way, that includes types of prospects that you run into. Like when you see people and you're like, oh, I've seen that before, you can probably predict the outcome.
Good answer.
Thank you.
One more.
Yep.
I get rid of that one. That's too close. You can't fix character flaws, integrity issues, or what your mama broke.
Yeah. So this goes back to my biz library days. And the owner and I had interviewed a candidate, and everything on paper looked great, and every answer sounded perfect. And we sat in his office and we were like, something's off. And we just couldn't put our finger on it. And we didn't like, you know, like that was like, that was the anti, like, do not hire from your gut, right? Like, we've done all the data, everything sounds, you know, whatever, like, but something felt off to us. And finally he said that. So that is not my Christyism. I stole that. But he said, you can't fix character flaws, integrity issues, or what mama broke. And one of those is probably at play here. So we should walk away. And so we did.
And I just want to double down on that for you leaders out there who, if a candidate comes to you and they've had a lot of success in the past and have been a top producer, but you could tell that they'd be an awful culture fit or there's just something wrong with the person, just kind of like exactly the situation you're talking about, don't go for it. It's the wrong thing. A short-term fix, especially if there's somebody who's like, hey, I'll bring my client list with you. What does that show about them? Right. You know what I mean?
Right.
Exactly. Right. So don't go for it because it's not going to work out in the long run. I've made that mistake before a long time ago where, you see there's maybe something off with this person, but you're thinking, well, they could bring in some good business and it was a nightmare. So it was a good learning lesson for me.
Before we
wrap up, is there anything, I got your book right here. Is there one or two other things you want to share with the listeners, either about how you serve your customers that you work with or a little bit more about your book?
Again, the book is available everywhere. It's finally back in stock at Amazon, so I'm grateful for that. Like I said, I think this book is for lots of people. Like, you know, I didn't want to write a how-to sales book. And I'm calling it the professional development book for sales professionals. So, but I also think there are a lot of other learnings in there that I think it would be entertaining for other people who weren't in sales. So get a copy, buy a second copy for someone who's not in sales and see what happens.
Yeah. So to kind of recap our conversation, we talked about what sets the top 10% apart from the 90%, you know, what they're doing outside of the office. We talked about getting very intentional about what your strengths are and maybe where you'd be good at, and even asking other people. We talked about things like knowing who you're surrounding yourself with. And for all of you out there who maybe aren't sure if sales is what direction you want to go, spend $20 and get Christy's book, go through it and see what you think, you know, give it a shot. I mean, like we said, I mean, people leave sales and on average, you could see that maybe it costs them $2 million. So why not spend the $20 and really think it through, right?
Thank you, Damon. Exactly. I couldn't have said it better myself. Thank you for the plug.
Where else can our listeners connect with you?
I would love for your listeners to connect with me on LinkedIn and drop me a message and let me know about your one takeaway from the podcast today. And if you're not sure where to get the book, you can go to sellingyourwayin.com and it will list a bunch of retailers there that you can snag the book at, but it should be, you should be able to buy it online at your favorite retailer.
Great. So listeners, I'm sure you got value out of today's conversation. Hit the subscribe button, but also do this. If you know somebody, like I mentioned, where maybe they're on the, you know, they're teetering to see if they want to get into sales, I want you to go to whatever platform you're on and text our conversation today, this episode, to them with a link to Christy's book and say, hey, listen to this, you know, on the Learn It All podcast, and then go out and buy Christy's book. So everybody, until next time, stay curious and keep learning. See you later.